Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Do our connections to the digital realm weaken our bonds to the people and places we encounter in the physical world? A few years ago, writer and social commentator Susan Mousehart decided the texting, gaming, chatting, and surfing behaviors of her three teenagers had reached an unhealthy point. One of her daughters was constantly sleep-deprived. Her son could spend hours on end playing video games. And the whole family could be together in the same room and barely interact with one another. So Mousehart took a radical step. She declared all screens entirely off-limits at home and in the family car for 6 months. And while going cold turkey was at least as hard for her as it was for her kids, Mousehart delighted in developing an appreciation and watching her kids develop an appreciation for many of the things in life that can only take place offline. Susan Mousehart's new book is called The Winter of Our Disconnect, How Three Totally Wired Teenagers and a Mother Who Slept with Her iPhone Pulled the Plug on Their Technology and Lived to Tell the Tale. Susan, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Describe what it was like in your house in the months and years leading up to this big change that made you think you had crossed the line where it came to technology.
Well, I guess I was just getting sick of looking at the backs of my three kids' heads. It had gotten to that point where, you know, eye contact, something that, you know, one normally took for granted or we used to days gone by, was becoming almost an event. And our conversations, and I put that in quotation marks, were always begun with me saying something like, would you mind pressing pause and, you know, could you just put that on hold? And, you know, as if real life was what was happening on the screen and everything else was just a commercial or an interruption of some kind. So I was worried about my kids. I was worried about the quality of the interaction that we were having. But I have to be honest and say I was also worried about myself and my own patterns.
Let's talk about this. I have to confess, your subtitle really got my attention because I know it's supposed to be this sort of over-the-top thing that gets your attention, but Mother Who Slept with Her iPhone, I have been known to do that. And I'm, in fact, happily married. But, you know, you get used to falling asleep sometimes with that sound in your ears, or you think, I need to check my email the moment I awaken. And really, nobody needs my attention that much.
Yes, you know, it's been an interesting experience. I believed that I was really aberrant, and it was shameful, and I would have to out myself about my deepest, darkest secrets of media use. And in the course of both researching the book and now having it sort of out there, I have realized my own pathologies are entirely normal, you know, for particularly for, you know, for people like us, kind of middle class educated people in some kind of professional work, and that goes double if you're in the media. So yeah, it's not so unusual to sleep with your iPhone, whether you do so brazenly or, you know, secretly. My relationship with my phone was starting to worry even me when I realized I had a pet name for it. I was buying it little outfits and jewelry and, you know, sneaking it into the bathroom and, you know, sneaking peeks at it even when I stopped for a red light.
Yeah, because there might be something. It's like that instant gratification of something you might be missing out on.
Yes, yes, and that's kind of the whole cycle that I was certainly caught up in my way, and my kids were caught up in their way. I mean, for the girls, it was very much social media that was driving them. That was the loop, and the thought of being out of that loop was unthinkable to them. And for me, it was, you know, my emails, my professional life, you know, keeping up with the news cycle. That was my loop. My son, of course, was in his gaming loop. But, you know, we were like a three-ring circus where the rings never overlapped. And that was the irony. And again, I'm realizing more and more how common this is, the irony that you can be connected 24/7 and yet, you know, disconnected from the people who are right in front of you.
Yeah, you know, as I was reading this book, Susan, I was thinking about the fact that a lot of parents now who have tweens and teens, you know, we get them a phone because we want to always be able to be in touch with them. And so we have this ability to helicopter parent from a distance thanks to our technology. But then when they're right in the room with us, we can't get their attention.
It's so true. And, you know, I have a lot of difficulties with the notion of, you know, always being connected electronically with our children, I have difficulty in, you know, convincing myself that that's a good thing either for them or for us.
Mm-hmm.
I think it can lull us into a false sense of security. There have been many times when I have been absolutely panicked on the other side to perhaps get out of a movie theater and open my phone and see that there are 50 missed calls. That's nothing in my household to see 50 missed calls. And I would, you know, my heart would be racing. I'd have adrenaline practically squirting out of my ears, call my kids back, and I would be told, oh, it's fine. We found the ketchup. You know, like, what is that about? I mean, what kind of an emergency is that? But on the other side, you know, I've had situations where my kids actually have been involved in, you know, something that I would class as an emergency, but they haven't had the phone. The mm-hmm. phone hasn't been charged. The prepaid minutes haven't been paid or whatever it was, or where you're dying to get in touch with them and you simply can't. You know, the whole assumptive world there of the phones, I think, really badly needs to be examined. And I think, you know, it can keep our kids from developing their own judgment and developing a sense of responsibility for their own actions. I tell the story in the book about a young man. He wasn't a 12-year-old. He was in his early 20s. I was having lunch with his mom at the time. That's how I know the story. Who was going to his first day on a job, and he's a brilliant boy. And he called his mother on her mobile phone, which was sitting there on the lunch table, as, you know, mothers tend to do that when they have lunch together,
mm-hmm.
even when their kids are in their 20s. And he called her to find out, get this, which way to turn when he got out of the train station. So he didn't know whether to go to the right or to the left. He called his mother rather than, I mean, you know, ask somebody who was right next to him. I found that extraordinary. And, you know, I have to say that exactly the same thing happened to me recently with one of my children. So I'm not passing judgment in that sense. I mean, I'm part of the problem, too. But I think we need to, you know, examine exactly how healthy that is.
So, Susan, talk about how you sprung this on your kids. I love that this was Christmas morning that you said, and by the way, here are your presents, and by the way,
yes.
I'm cutting you off from all screen technology for 6 months.
Yes, it was kind of perhaps a strange moment to have picked, but then there were plenty of distractions. There were lights and color and presents and, you know, candy and all those good things that you want. To soften the blow. As it turned out, it was probably a fairly well-chosen moment because people were in a marvelous mood. We mm-hmm. also happened to have gone away for Christmas that year with some friends, and we went to a holiday location that we had often been to before, a very remote little fishing village off the coast of Western Australia, because we were living in Australia at the time. And it was so remote that in order to get a signal, even on your cell phone, you had to climb to the highest dune in the village and sort of wave your phone around. So as you might imagine, that little point was full of teenagers waving phones. But it was kind of, we loved being there because it did have that wonderful effect on our family. After a day or so, everybody kind of not only got used to it, but we really prized the time together, and it was a very positive setting for us. So I just kind of said, well, you know how much we love being at Gracetown where we can't use any of our technology. Guess what? We're going to continue to have a wonderful time for the next 6 months.
Is it true that you wrote most of what became this book in longhand?
Not most of it, but I did write the first couple of chapters very painfully in longhand, and I hated every minute of it.
Did it change your... You've been writing, obviously, throughout your career. Did it change your relationship to the process itself?
Totally. Yes, very much so. I mean, my sort of bread-and-butter job is as a weekly columnist for the national newspaper in Australia, which is called The Australian, appropriately enough,
mm-hmm.
and I've been writing a column for over a decade. I know absolutely exactly what my word length is at a glance just by looking. I mean, even before Microsoft Word was telling you how many words at the bottom of the page, I could tell just from the look of the page. Being able to see paragraphs as chunks of, you know, justified text. Being able to write and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. I just could not believe when I sat down with an old-fashioned notebook and a pen that I would go through easily a page of rewrite to get to one sentence. And then I'd start over again, and I'd write the next sentence, and then a page. It was so hard. It gave me some insight into the way I do write and all the editing that goes into it, but I did not find it fun. I hoped that I would be like one of those kind of old-school novelists who still, you know, prefers to write with not a quill pen, perhaps, but a fountain pen, but no, it wasn't for me. I couldn't wait to get back to my keyboard.
My guest is columnist, author, and social commentator Susan Mousehart. Her new book is called The Winter of Our Disconnect, How Three Totally Wired Teenagers and a Mother Who Slept with Her iPhone Pulled the Plug on Their Technology and Lived to Tell the Tale. We'll resume our conversation with Susan in a moment. We'd welcome you to join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Jeff Whittington is in the studio now. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Chris, and what a great conversation. And take a moment right now, folks. You won't miss a minute of this incredible conversation if you just take this moment right now and call 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org and make a contribution there. You might consider the $120 membership level, and when you join at the station at that level, today we will thank you with your very own copy of Susan's book.
Which I have to say, we're having sort of a serious discussion this afternoon. The book is laugh-out-loud funny. I just can't wait to read more that and sign up and get Susan's columns, because she's very, very witty, and I think a lot of us can identify with what she's talking about, but you'll also really find it a fun read.
Well, we've covered the technological age issue from a bunch of different angles on the show this new year.
Pro and con and anti. And
exactly. Yeah. And it's really interesting to get this sort of personal family level view, because this is an issue that affects us all. I mean, you know, we in my home, my wife and I'll be sitting there texting each other across the table.
Past the salt.
It seems like. So, this is just part of the deal of living this modern life. And I think it's really interesting to see what happens when we sort of take a step back. We were talking about TV of yesteryear in the last hour, Chris. And now you're talking about sort of the communication style of yesteryear.
And of tomorrow.
That's perhaps.
1-888-694-6931 is the number to call to support this radio station. You can also make your contribution online quickly and easily at kera.org. If you're interested, you can choose from a variety of thank you gifts. And your contribution to the station really makes a huge difference in our ability to continue bringing you this programming. It all adds up over time. We have these budgets that are set by the folks who know exactly what it's going to cost to meet our expenses. We are not here to make a profit. We are here to serve you.
Yeah, 888-694-6931 is the phone number. Of course, I mentioned earlier, it's a little bit more efficient if you go online to kera.org and make your contribution there. You can do it a number of ways. You can use a credit card, which is great because it goes to work. Your contribution goes to work right away when you do that. Or you can ask for an invoice, and we'll send you one, and you can send us back a check. Or you can become a sustaining member. You can do that online now, and you can set it up with your credit card or your bank account. It divides your annual gift, say $120, into monthly payments of, in that case, $10 that are transferred straight from your account to KERA. But whichever way you do it, please do it. Please don't wait. Please call 888-694-6931 or contribute at kera.org.
Your choice to make a contribution to this station is something you can feel good about, not just today, but throughout the year. We'd love to hear from you now online at kera.org or 1-888-694-6931.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is columnist and author Susan Mousehart. Her new book is called The Winter of Our Disconnect, How Three Totally Wired Teenagers and a Mother Who Slept with Her iPhone Pulled the Plug on Their Technology and Lived to Tell the Tale. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372. You know, Susan, I think it's fascinating that you can write a book about this radical idea to take away access to technology that nobody even had 20 years ago.
Oh, look, that is such a great point, Chris. There's a part of me that is just standing back in like disbelief that anybody is interested in a book where people essentially don't use a computer for 6 months when that was all of us 20 years ago.
Yeah.
It just shows how fast, how furious, how unrelenting this technological change has been, to the point where all of us, myself very much included, have lost our bearings and believe that this is the way life is, the way life has to be. And I guess I was blown away by early responses, just by friends and colleagues and so on, to my idea to do this. How many people said, "Oh, I see, you're going back to the 19th century," and I mean, it's true. we did have television, even when I was growing up, and we did in our experiment give up TV as well. But essentially, we were really only going back to something more like what, 1985?
Yeah. You know, I thought it was really telling, too, that, you know, it stands to reason that your kids and their friends would take umbrage at this idea and resist, at least initially. You had a funny experience when you realized that your own peers thought that you were going overboard in denying your kids access to these things.
Yes, I found that really interesting. And, well, I had an unusual kind of firsthand view of what some people at least were thinking, because I had, perhaps, you know, you've had one of these experiences where you're talking to somebody on the phone and then you hang up, but for some reason the phone doesn't really hang up on the other end.
Uh-huh.
This happened to me in the first week of the experiment. I was talking to the father of one of my daughter Sassy's friends, and I realized that the phone was still connected and he was having a conversation with people in his house about what we were doing. And it was, I was mortified, but of course I listened to every single word. I turned the volume up as loud as I possibly could, because it's such a rare experience in life to hear a whole conversation about yourself, even if it wasn't really that flattering. I mean, what they were saying was, you know, this is a pretty much an outrageous thing to do to your children. They're going to suffer scholastically. They're going to suffer socially. Why would she inflict this on her family?
Hmm.
And in my naivete, I was kind of shocked by that.
Was the fear that you would be bored and that your kids would be bored, was that actually worse than the boredom itself when it finally set in?
Oh, absolutely. Our fear of boredom, and I'm talking collectively, all mm-hmm. of us, my own as well, was pretty huge.
Yeah.
And it was the first thing that the kids came up with when I started thinking about the whole idea, which I did probably one day when I, you know, was looking again at the backs of three heads and just sort of said in exasperation, and it was a rhetorical question at the time, you know, what would our lives be like without all this stuff, you know, without all these screens? What would our lives be like? And my son, who was gaming at the time, didn't even bother turning around. He just said, our lives would be boring. That's what they'd be. And that sort of started a conversation between himself and myself, and it started a train of thought for me. I thought, well, that's, you know, think of what you're saying. Are you saying that throughout all of human history until, you know, the creation of Halo, everybody was bored all the time? And he's kind of ticking this over. He's continuing to kind of snipe at people online. And then he said, well, they must have been. They must have been bored, Mom, because that's why they invented the computer. And I thought it was a clever answer, but it was far cleverer than he knew at the time. I felt he had dug himself a little hole, because, you know, I jumped all over that and said, well, you know, well, you're calling it boredom. And maybe what it really is just a space to be creative. Maybe it's just having, you know, an inner life. Will you ever invent a computer? Maybe you never will, because you're always siphoning all this kind of low-level distraction and content. You're never, quote-unquote, bored. But, you know, what does that mean? Maybe we need more boredom in our lives. And, of course, he was already bored by the conversation and went back. But that's really, that was a big turning point for me.
And ultimately, he took what felt like boredom to him and channeled it really productively.
He did. He did. I mean, you know, I couldn't have masterminded it better if I tried to prove my point, because what happened with that very child, my son Bill, was that within a couple of days of kind of gritting his teeth and enduring this boredom, he found his old saxophone in the back of the closet where it had been gathering dust for a couple of years. He hadn't played it for a really, really long time. And over the course of the experiment, he essentially swapped over his game for the saxophone. Hi, honey. That's my daughter just coming home from school. I put a note for you on the door to tell you I'm doing an interview right now.
I love this moment because I have these all the time.
She's like, what are you pointing at? What are you pointing at? I put a huge note on the door.
Maybe if you'd texted her, she would know that.
I did text her. Honey, I texted you. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, anyway, I'm glad she made it home safely.
And she did.
I think you write in the book also that it took all the maternal restraint you had ever exercised not to say, I told you so, when your son said, I probably never would have done this if I hadn't unplugged.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are times when you just have to jam your fist into your mouth and let it play and let it play.
I admired you for doing that, because I'm not sure I would have had that much restraint. Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We'll speak with Kent in Richardson. Hello, Kent.
Hello. Susan, I just wanted to ask this question. Do you think that by, continuing to text and use all the computer, you know, gadgets we have, it's decreasing the ability of children to be able to cope in this world, for example, have social skills, being able to talk to one another or adults, and being able to figure stuff out for themselves. Mm. If they get a flat tire, do they know how to fix a flat tire instead of calling mom? Or do they know how to read a map? Things that we all take for granted, and I still use. But these kids these days have no clue on any of this stuff. And these are coping skills that they're going to need when they become adults, if they ever do become adults, and move out of the house.
Well, hopefully they'll make it there. What do you think about that, Susan?
Okay, I think you raise a really interesting point. And not to be too self-serving about this, but if you go to my website, because I know you'll find it there, on SusanMousehart.com, there's an article by a woman named Beth Harpaz from Associated Press from a couple of months ago, and it's called Are We Raising a Generation of Nincompoops? And it basically looks at exactly this question, whether our children are not developing extremely basic life skills. And forget about changing a tire. I'm talking about opening a can with a can opener. I do think the short answer is that I do think that the sheer amount of time that we're spending in the virtual world is compromising our ability to do stuff in RL, in real life. maybe it will give rise to a whole new class of people that we outsource things to. I mean, I think it probably is already.
Professional can openers.
Professional can openers.
Well, I love that you brought this up. Literally 3 days ago, I had to teach my 11-year-old how to use, you know, a hand can opener. And he said, well, we just don't eat things out of cans, which is would have been anathema in my childhood.
Yes, indeed. Indeed, you'd starve to death. my kids always say, get the ones with the ring pulls. You know, yeah. What's wrong with that?
Talk about the kinds of conversations that you suddenly found yourself having with your kids that had been unusual before.
The kinds of conversations. I suppose conversations that might happen around the dinner table, because the dinner table was just really a pit stop.
Mm-hmm.
Before, because people would come and speed eat and race back to their respective workstations, so-called, even though there wasn't a lot of work going on there. I think back to an encounter I had with my youngest daughter, Sussy, probably midway through the experiment when we sat down, you know, obviously we'd been deprived of Facebook. We sat down with a box of actual photographs, you know, Facebook before there was Facebook, with people sitting around and looking at faces.
Hard copies, you know, of faces, yeah.
Hard copies, and that's exactly what she said. Look at all those hard copies. Oh, my God. And, you know, there was just, it was a wonderful time of sharing. There was a much different energy to it than you would have by just kind of sitting side by side and looking at stuff online. Partly it was that, you know, just that it was tactile. You know, you could pass things hand to hand. There was an opportunity to, you know, ask questions and go deeply into things related to our family and fashion and, you know, Grammy's hairdo back in 1969. You know, I think like so many other things in our lives, it was a time that we actually drilled down a little bit because we had the time and we had the attention and we had the headspace.
Susan Mousehart is my guest. She's a columnist, author, and social commentator. Her new book is called The Winter of Our Disconnect, How Three Totally Wired Teenagers and a Mother Who Slept with Her iPhone Pulled the Plug on Their Technology and Lived to Tell the Tale. We'll be back with Susan in a couple of minutes and invite you to join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. For the next few minutes, though, we would ask you to pay attention to our other contact places. Go to KERA.org, make a financial contribution there, perhaps receive a copy of Susan Mousehart's book as a thank you gift at the $120 level. You can also make your contribution on the phone at 1-888-694-6931. Hello, Jeff Whittington.
Hello, Chris Boyd. I want to thank Anton Skoronsky in Dallas, Miriam Manyara-Dean in Dallas, and John Edwards from Omaha, Nebraska.
Thanks also to James Donovan in Omaha, Nebraska.
Hmm,
up with Omaha.
What's going on?
Jill Dunn in Dallas, David Meredith in Garland. You know, we do have a lot of folks who listen to this show in particular and also to your show on the podcast or via computer. And we very much appreciate when you support these programs from a distance, because whether you listen in North Texas or somewhere else, the programming is here for you.
Yeah. When we were during the break, the program break, I was talking with Jackie Fisher, our membership campaign producer, and she said, you know, if those 82,000 people who downloaded the Think podcast in December, if they would just each go on to the support page and give the station $10, the drive would be over.
Yeah,
I mean, think about that. So if you listen to the podcast, if you download the podcast and listen religiously, then, you know, did I get it wrong, Jackie?
Jackie Boyer.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Jackie. So I stand corrected. It's been a long day. So, you know, if you listen to the podcast, if you enjoy the podcast and you're hearing our plea here, then, you know, why not send a little money to the station to help offset the cost of producing it?
That will guarantee that the show stays here for you, as you have come to count on every weekday between noon and 2, Monday through Thursday. And then, of course, on Fridays, you have Anything You Ever Wanted to Know with Jeff Whittington. We would love to hear from you now online at KERA.org or at 1-888-694-6931. Let me tell you, we take great pride in using your money very, very stingily around here. We are careful not to spend any more than we have to, because we want to put it all to the programs that you care about and that we care about providing for you.
Absolutely. And we listen to the station, too. And we want to make sure that the programming quality stays the highest possible level that it can possibly be. And, you know, we get a lot of feedback from you and it's great that you think that the Think program fits really nicely between Fresh Air and Tell Me More, which are both produced at other stations but are nationally distributed programs on NPR and I believe PRI. So, you know, we appreciate that, and we want to make sure that we continue to bring you the kind of programming that you expect from an NPR affiliate in the fifth media market in the country. And that's what this is. So help us offset the cost of bringing you this programming. It doesn't have to, you don't have to cover the whole budget. You only have to do what is comfortable for you. And if you know, a couple hundred dollars is right, maybe $120. Maybe if you want to take a friend, You can do $240, and we'll send you two tickets to see Paula Poundstone at the Majestic Theater.
And then you get to meet her after the show.
There is a meet and greet after the show. It's a $120 per ticket on a credit card. These are a limited number of tickets. They're in really great seats, rows A through H, I believe, and you get to go to a meet and greet after the show.
I should point out, by the way, stingy was perhaps the wrong word. Frugal is the right word. We take pride around here in flipping off all the lights when we don't need them in a room and printing things on both sides of the paper. It's one of those moments. No, I'm just saying that, you know, we are proud of the fact that, that we try to operate lean and mean so that we can give you what you need and so that your money, you get to hear it being used.
That's right. I'm usually following Chris Boyd around. You know, turning the lights back on. So
it's You're just not like, stingy enough.
It's just like my mother works here. Somebody's mother works here.
I'm not washing your dishes.
No, absolutely not. And I wouldn't ask you to, Chris. But we would ask you to call 888-694-6931. I'm asking you to go online right now to KERA.org and help pay for the programs that you appreciate, help pay for the service that you use, and help continue to create this reality of a place where we look at issues that are important from a bunch of different angles and talk to a guest like Susan Mousehart. And maybe you want to get her book about her personal family experience of disconnecting, to use her word, from social media and things with a screen, and actually having a human relationship with her family for a period of time. So we can thank you with a copy of that book at the $120 membership level.
It's definitely on my list to recommend to all my friends who have teenagers, because you'll relate and maybe get some insight from checking it out.
Dogs are so much easier, Chris.
They don't text.
They don't ask
for unlimited messaging.
Yeah, there's no video game that has to be purchased for the dogs, although they do like to play Chase the Chicken.
And do they not also take up space on the couch when you want to sit there?
They do, and they chew things. But that's it. There's nothing. There's
no
nothing,
college expenses.
That's right. That's
but
right.
They won't take care of you when you're old.
That's true. That's true.
All right. We very much digress, but we would love to hear from you right now online at KERA.org. You can make your contribution there. Check out thank you gifts. We have a whole bunch of things to choose from if you are interested. You can also give us a call at 1-888-694-6931 and make a contribution there. Use a debit or a credit card, or set up a check or a sustaining membership. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Susan Mousehart.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author, columnist, and social commentator Susan Mousehart. Her new book is called The Winter of Our Disconnect, How Three Totally Wired Teenagers and a Mother Who Slept with Her iPhone Pulled the Plug on Their Technology and Lived to Tell the Tale. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Can you talk about the fact that far from being socially ostracized, your house became the place where kids wanted to hang out?
Yeah, how weird is that?
Yeah.
I mean, you can never underestimate the perversity of teenagers.
Or predict
just
it.
When you think, you know, you've got them pegged, they pull the rug out from under you. And yes, we would have assumed that, you know, nobody would darken our door for 6 months because they couldn't go and watch YouTubes and they couldn't play games and they couldn't go on Facebook or MySpace. But instead, it seemed to be just the opposite, that it was, you know, the novelty value of coming to a place where you had no choice but to do something else was a huge draw card.
Suddenly, people, it's a sanctuary.
Yeah, it was exactly. It was a haven, I think, in many ways, that people could come and play board games. It did. You didn't look like a dork if you wanted to play Monopoly all day on Sunday afternoon. Or even, you know, a more childish game. I mean, the kids dragged out everything from their old watercolor sets to, you know, my son, who was 16, you know, in the middle of the experiment and over 6 feet tall, was sitting on the ground building towers out of blocks with his equally hulking friends and having a wonderful time. I recount in the book one night we had some friends over and they brought their teenagers and, you know, everybody knew that technology was off limits, and the kids who after dinner would always end up at their separate screens or hunched over somebody's mobile phone, spent this evening playing hide-and-seek all through the house. It was so delightful. And so, I mean, I think they were as shocked by how much fun they were having as we were in watching them.
You know, there's a really beautiful poignancy to the book, and it comes, I think, from the fact that you mentioned that your son was 16, your older daughter, I think, was 18 at the time.
That's right.
And they were at that point where this was really your last chance to know they'd be living in your house and to have those final times to bond with each other.
That's very perceptive. That's very true. And that is also what gave me the push to do it as I did it when I did it. It was kind of like, yes, this is our last chance. We've got a little window here, and you know, let's see what we can make of it. And I am eternally grateful that we were able to take advantage of that. It is for all of us, not just for me, but for all of us. Bizarrely enough, a kind of golden time in our lives.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We'll speak to Marley in Sobler. Hi, Marley.
Hi. I just wanted to thank Susan for her courage to embark on such an endeavor with her teenagers. But also, I think she inadvertently just set the standard and set the new curriculum for our home ec classes for the future.
Interesting. Well, thank you very much for that. You know, I just keep in mind, though, that I was driven to this extremity of unplugging because I was so bad at setting limits. So I have a hard time seeing myself as any kind of a role model. But I'm hoping that the book will actually get people to think, to think twice, and to be more deliberate and more conscious in the way they use media. That's my goal. I mean, I'm not a Luddite myself, and in fact, I love technology. So the message of the book is not that technology is bad and we would all live better lives without it. I mean, that's simplistic. It simply isn't so. But what is the case, I think, is that we tend to use our media in a way that's unexamined. And I think we would all probably lead better lives if we examined it from time to time.
I thought it was really interesting because one of the arguments your kids had against limits on screen time is they would say, but I'm doing homework, and you would look over their shoulder and there was Facebook or MySpace or video or something, which is what a lot of adults do too, that spend hours online. Part of that time is not necessarily productive.
Oh, that is so true. That is so true. I mean, it is a culture-wide scam that kids are perpetrating on their parents, and as you say, parents and adults are perpetrating on themselves and perhaps on their employers from time to time. You know, the idea that just because you're in front of a screen, well, we use the term, and I think this is kind of hilarious, multitasking, when usually, you know, nine-tenths of the quote-unquote tasks in question are pure entertainment. Mm-hmm. You know, my son calls it multitasking, or he used to when he was watching, what's that show where they do the pranks?
A
show like Punk'd. Just a crazy kind of stupid show all about, you know, people inflicting self-harm. That was a task. You know,
I guess if you're 15 and you're a boy, it probably is some kind of task.
Yes. But, you know, with that kind of thinking does carry over. And so we sort of justify to ourselves, more than justify, almost glorify, our many involvements as, you know, we're being super busy and that translates into super productive and we're super task-oriented, when in fact a good deal of the time, I mean, we're just fooling around.
What about you, like, with work contacts? Obviously, people communicate a lot of information these days via email. Mm-hmm. How did people respond when you said, please call me?
People thought I was having a nervous breakdown, to be honest with you. I left what I now realize was a somewhat spooky message, an out-of-office reply on my email account, which said words to the effect of, I am in an email-free zone indefinitely.
Like you're locked up somewhere.
Yeah, exactly, like I've been taken a hostage. And I did give my street address and my landline number, which I, you know, friends and relatives were also shocked at. And, you know, how can you do that? And, you know, you've got to safeguard your privacy. And which, you know, in thinking about it, I was like, well, you know, really anybody can get hold of my email address and send a message hurtling at full speed into my lap practically during my work day. And, you know, that's a violation of my privacy too.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas at least if they sort of send me a letter and it ends up in my mailbox, it's not going to, you know, it's not going to go bang into the middle of my life in the same way. So, you know, it's very interesting. I think going off email for a person of my age and profession was maybe the most radical thing of all.
Yeah.
And it was certainly the thing that I loved best.
Huh. Suddenly you had freedom to think things through in your own time and not constantly be chasing after your email.
Oh, I felt so liberated.
Uh-huh.
I felt like, you know, I hadn't realized how much of a fugitive I'd been feeling, you know, like a fugitive from, you know, just from requests and, readers from demands of all kinds. I mean, email is relentless. You don't need me to tell you this. It comes at you literally 24 hours a day, and it is always a task. It's always, you know, an answer that needs to be given or a fact that needs to be found or a document that needs to be sent. And to live your life without that, even for a brief period, was literally better than a holiday.
Did you have to prepare yourself for the moment that everything switched back on?
Well, I did have to prepare because I needed to, like, physically make sure that we had an internet service provider back online.
Yeah.
I had promised the kids that after 6 months of total deprivation, they would have 6 months where I wouldn't impose any limits at all.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we beefed up our sort of digital armory to a certain degree. Like, we got a big, cable TV package that we hadn't had before. I even got new furniture for the TV room. I had an electrician come in and put bright lights everywhere so that when we switched on like you wouldn't believe. We went on a huge media bender. I must say, by that point in the proceedings, I was totally ready to be connected again. You know, we were living in Australia at the time. The seasons are reversed, so that the winter of our disconnect was actually the second half of our 6 months.
Right.
So when we switched on again on Independence Day, July 4th, it was actually midwinter at that point. And contrary to what many people think about Australia, it's cold in the winter.
And dark.
And dark. Mm-hmm. And it's particularly cold in the house. It may stay reasonable outside in the sun if the sun is shining, but houses aren't really built for the cold and they're drafty. And it's a pretty miserable time. It's actually been quite astonishing to me to realize that I'm warm, overly warm, in my house in New York in the middle of winter most of the time. I'm constantly throwing up the windows. But anyway, yeah, I was so ready to be able to sit down and watch a movie in my own home. We'd spent many, many, many evenings as a family all rugged up staring at the fireplace as if it were, you know, as if the fire were American Idol or something. And I was, you know, I was pretty over that.
Yeah.
So, I didn't really have to prepare myself mentally. I felt like I was ready to go back.
Well, Susan, it was a fascinating experiment and really well told in the book. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Susan Mousehart is a columnist, author, and social commentator. Her new book is called The Winter of Our Disconnect, How Three Totally Wired Teenagers and a Mother Who Slept with Her iPhone Pulled the Plug on Their Technology and Lived to Tell the Tale. We have copies of the book available this afternoon when you join us at the $120 level or above. You can do that by going online to kera.org, or if you prefer, you can do this via phone at 1-888-694-6931. Jeff Whittington is back. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. Yeah, you can't text your pledge in just yet, but
we
are
actually working on that.
We've talked about it, but you can use your smartphone. You can go onto the website. You can call us. Please use technology to make your contribution. Or, you know what, you can do it old school. You can just mail a contribution into the station or just bring a contribution by. But whatever you do this week and next week during this membership campaign, please do make a contribution, because your contribution makes a difference. And, you know, you don't have to be strong. You don't have to be spectacularly wealthy. You don't have to do anything, but participate. And that's what we're asking you to do, is just participate with a few dollars at KERA.org or on the phone at 888-694-6931.
And if I could make one additional request, thank you very much for your contribution. After you've made it, let your friends know. Let them know via Twitter or Facebook or whatever else you use to communicate. There are probably six new things that have been invented that I'm so far unaware of. But let folks know, because it really does. You are a much bigger influence on the people in your circle than we could ever be, no matter what we say. So we really appreciate you letting folks know that you believe public radio is important.
Yeah, I mean, if think about the exponential power of that. And I believe we do have a way you can, when you make your contribution online now, you can click a button and it will add something to your Facebook status that says that you have made your contribution. So check that out when you go to KERA.org. And you might choose to receive Susan Mousehart's very entertaining book, The Winter of Our Disconnect. Tells the whole story without pledge breaks about what it was like for her to get her family to turn off all those devices, including herself, and have that experience, the sort of the pre-technological revolution experience.
She's not quite so joke a minute, but you definitely hear echoes in her writing of Irma Bombeck, maybe a 21st century Irma Bombeck, in the way she looks at herself, and she's got a great sense of humor. I mean, she turns that around on herself more than anything, but it's a really entertaining read, and also one that has, you know, I think some deeper meaning to it. So it's a great thing to check out. Again, we have copies available. If you want to do it this way, make your contribution to KERA.org of $120, and then we will send you your copy of the book.
Yeah.
Just go online to KERA.org or call 1-888-694-6931.
Online at KERA.org, you can see a variety of thank you gifts. You can see member rewards partners. Those are people all over town and all over the area and businesses that will give you a discount of some sort when you become a member of KERA. You just show your member rewards card, your membership card, and you actually get a discount there. And you can end up paying for your membership if you use it enough to save money at different businesses and even service-oriented businesses. I think there are even auto service places on there, Chris. I mean, it's a long list of companies and also other nonprofits and theaters and museums and places like that. So check that out when you're at KERA.org. But please do go to the station's website or to call 888-694-6931 and make that contribution today.
The wonderful thing about making a contribution to KERA is, one, you've already been using the service. Two, you know what you're paying for. You know what your money is purchasing for you and for all of North Texas, because you tune in every day and you hear it. You count on it. You know when we're doing something new. We know that you communicate to us when you like something. We also hear from you if you don't like something, and that's okay, too. We welcome it all. You know, we never guarantee that everything on this station is going to reflect exactly what you believe about the world, and we're glad about that, because we're not here to promote any one particular worldview. We are here to just, particularly on this show, we just want to explore how people have arrived at their conclusions and why they think what they think.
Yeah, there are other national and locally produced talk shows that you can hear right here in North Texas that will tell you what to think and will sort of push forward one view or the other and one opinion and one maybe even political position, or most certainly a political position. You won't find that here, because we take it really seriously to provide you with a variety of viewpoints on the issues that we cover. And, you know, as Chris says, it's not, we don't tell you what to think. We just hope that we give you something to think about and a conversation in which you can participate. Right here on KERA 90.1, your source for NPR News, Dallas-Fort Worth Denton. So it is your station, and it is your responsibility to help pay the bills. So please don't wait. Call 888-694-6931 or contribute online at KERA.org.
It is sort of remarkable in the modern media climate that treating guests with respect and civility and expecting callers to do the same and all of us interacting in ways that really speak to respect is unique in the broadcast landscape. We're really proud to do it this way. It's the only way we know how or want to do it. Your support makes it clear that you feel the same way, that you want there to be a space where people speak to each other with respect and with understanding and with a sincere desire to know what's going on before you form your opinions. We appreciate your support for that, and you can let us know when you go online and make a pledge at KERA.org or make a contribution at 1-888-694-6931. Thanks.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.